Support for TPR comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas's largest research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org. Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.
Live from the John L. Santikos studio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Democracy around the world is not in a great place. The number of countries moving towards authoritarianism is double the number of countries that are finding their way towards democracy. And the quality of democracy around the world is also in decline, and that includes here in the United States. That's according to the Stockholm-based International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance International IDEA. They have issued their latest annual report looking at the state of democracy around the world, and they're saying it's time to forge new social contracts about democracy and remind people why democracy is important as we're dealing with the time of a failing democracy. When it comes to the United States, it's classified as a backsliding democracy, and we're now joined by Seema Shaw. She is the head of the Democracy Assessment Unit for the Stockholm-based International IDEA. And Dr. Shaw, welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much.
So you say the United States is a backsliding democracy. Can you tell us why?
Yes. At IDEA, we define backsliding to mean a statistically significant drop in three areas. One is checks on government, one is civil liberties, and one is clean elections. And so you have to be declining on those three aspects over a five-year period to be backsliding. So this is the second year the United States has been classified as backsliding.
So the United States has an ineffective parliament, which is our Congress. They have not been able to fully investigate former President Donald Trump. He's been able to disobey and ignore subpoenas in that case. We have a judiciary that has losing its independence. We've seen SCOTUS and some federal judges who've shown that they have a particular political point of view, and that's getting in the way of their doing their jobs. And you report that there is a loss of civil liberties in the United States, which is we're seeing declines in freedom of expression, association, and assembly. So is that all correct? And why are these things important?
That is all correct. And I mean, it's important because that's really the heart of democracy, is the freedom to say what you want, gather together and voice your opinion. Obviously, Congress and the courts act as a check on the executive branch. And, you know, that's been sort of the pride of American democracy for all these years, is that we have an effective system of checks and balances. No one branch can overstep its boundaries, et cetera. And that seems to be coming apart a little bit.
Our number is 833-877-8255. 833-TPR-TALK. And you can tweet at us at TPRSource. Send an email to The Source at thesource@tpr.org. And we'd love to hear your take on the state of democracy around the world and here in the United States. Also, in Mexico, we're really curious about what's happening in Mexico. So give us a call about your thoughts and your observations about that. So, Seema Shaw, have you looked at what's happening in Mexico? There's concern that Mexico's independent democracy could be challenged currently.
Yes, it is a concern. Actually, some of our experts recently have raised concerns about the fact that Mexico is attempting to change the way that its elections are run, elections are governed, which is a cause for concern as well.
So President Andres Manuel López Obrador, he has his party controls both houses of Congress, most state governorships in Mexico, and he is pushing for a dramatic overhaul in the institutions that critics say would strip away their autonomy and allow him to concentrate power into the hand of the ruling party and almost return it to something that we saw back in the days of the PRI. And we saw, you know, Mexico went from not a healthy democracy or even a democracy or full democracy, and it found its way into one. So you have to be aware that this is always a danger. This is always a concern.
Yes.
And so one thing that is brought out that we have to remind people of the benefits of democracy. We hear frequently from supporters of authoritarianism that it is a more effective form of government and that it is to have a strong man in charge, someone who doesn't have to bother with elections or even a parliament, that they think, well, this is they're able to outform their democratic peers. And so how do we explain to them that that is not the case? It's actually just the opposite.
It is exactly the opposite. There are lots of studies out there that show that democracies result in better outcomes for people across all kinds of indicators, including gender equality, including health, including business outcomes. There's an increasing case nowadays that democracies do better also in terms of addressing climate change. There's all kinds of benefits to democracy, but also just even apart from those studies, democracy is about providing people with the chance to pursue the goals that are important to them in the way they wish to pursue them and living lives with dignity. And that's not always possible in an authoritarian regime because you don't have the freedom to pursue what you want. So that's sort of a core difference.
Authoritarian regimes are corrupt. That's baked into the structure of the government. And also, the individuals don't have the protection of the rule of law. You are subjected to the law of the ruler. And that is capricious, arbitrary, and can be punitive, doesn't protect racial and religious minorities. We really have to figure out why we love democracy. It should be obvious, but we have to talk about it. And we want to talk about it. And our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We're going to continue this conversation after 1 minute. Stay with us. In the latest episode of the TPR podcast, The Ghost of Frank J. Robinson.
I believe he was killed. I really do. I believe he was assassinated.
New secrets are revealed about what people were saying about the mysterious death of Frank J. Robinson.
And we heard a boom, then that white van took off.
And new insights come to light about the official investigation and missing documents. Download and subscribe to The Ghost of Frank J. Robinson wherever you get your favorite podcast. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the global state of democracy. We're joined by Seema Shaw, PhD, head of the Democracy Assessment Unit at the Stockholm-based International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance, International IDEA. So there are 173 countries in the world that are tracked by this. The good news is most of them, 104, are considered to be democracies. But the problem is with that, it's been stagnant. It stayed at 104 countries over the last decade being democracies. This comes at a time when the world is seeing growing and complex problems, including renewed threats from nuclear warfare, climate disasters, and also aggressive states like Russia invading places like Ukraine. So why do we need to embrace democracy, preserve democracy, fight for democracy? Give us a call. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Seema, why do you think that democracy right now is in trouble?
I think there's a bunch of reasons why it's in trouble. One is that, you know, leaders are being forced to do a lot at once. There's a whole complex set of challenges in our kind of background context, like you mentioned just now, the resurgence of war, resurgence of nuclear threat, impending climate disaster, cost of living crisis, you know, a digitalization space that is very hard to manage. So leaders are having to do that while also thinking about the need to renegotiate our values through this social contract. What do we want? How do governments respond to people's changing needs at the same time as they're dealing with these background crises? It's a lot. It's a lot for a government to try and figure out, for example, how do I protect a freedom of expression when there's this risk of hate speech and incitement to violence in digital spaces? How do I do that? What's the effective balance there? How do I respond to climate change when I already know that the people that are disproportionately affected by climate change are populations that are already marginalized and facing, you know, intersectional inequalities of poverty, race, socioeconomic burdens? So how do you do all that at once? It's very difficult.
Let's go to a caller. Our number is 833-877-8255. And Billy, you're on the air. Billy, go ahead.
Good morning. I'm calling about the effects of the corporations on the democratic process and how can it be addressed with corruption in mind. Thank you.
Thank you, Billy. Seema Shaw.
If I understand the question correctly, it's about corruption.
Corporations.
So that's a really hard question. I think, you know, the United States kind of, unfortunately, is used as an example around the world because corporations have such an outsized influence on the political process, especially when you think about campaign finance and money in politics. So I think one thing to do would be to think about looking around the world for other models of how to regulate finance and the undue influence and disproportionate influence of wealthy players on the political process, but also to think about what can we do to incentivize corporations to act with more transparency and more accountability? What can we do to frame it in a way that makes it worth their while? These are sorts of new questions that we're encouraging people to think about as they, like we say in the report, renegotiate the social contract.
So the social contract, I think that, you know, let's get down to basics, first principles here about what that is and what we expect out of a government and why a democracy is going to provide us the best deal for a social contract. Can you talk about that?
So the social contract is the agreement that we have. It's an implicit agreement between the people and their government. So the people pay taxes, the people give legitimacy to the government, and the people agree to have certain rights restricted in exchange for stability, security, certain protections, job opportunities. And traditionally, these things have been thought about in terms of like healthcare, education, pension, social security. But now what we're saying is actually those are bare bones social contracts. We think people are demanding much more. So in response to this changing context, people want inequality addressed much more aggressively. People want marginalized voices much more at the front and center. And so one really good example of that is when we think about a basic like childcare. Childcare in the United States is very expensive. And if you're trying to work and you have young children and they can't go to school yet, what do you do? That can eat up your salary. So one of the things we talk about in the report is the importance of recognizing the care economy as a contributor to the national economy. And we need to recognize its importance and rethink childcare, not as a benefit to women, but as a public good. This is a public good for society. And so other countries have started doing things like developing community-based childcare. So it's less expensive, it's reliable because it's based right in your community, and it allows adults, women and men, to work more freely. So maybe a renegotiation of the social contract would mean We expect our government to provide safe, reliable childcare at an affordable price.
So I asked you earlier about why do you think we're having such a tough time with democracy around the world. And one of the reasons you mentioned was the digital space that we're kind of into. And I take that to mean we get a lot of social media. We see a lot of misinformation, a lot of hate coming our way. Even if you try to, you know, block all that in your social media feed, you're still going to get that. Or a lot of people won't, or they're not blocking it, they're embracing it. And there are bad actors. We know that this is happening under Putin in Russia. He has millions of dollars that they spend in order to provide cover and hate and information in order to go into the social media sphere to attack democracy and also turn people against each other in our democracies. We've seen that here in the United States. So how big of a threat is this organized effort to undermine democracy using social media, feeding on hate?
It's a massive threat. It's an absolutely massive threat, because what it does is, I mean, in the worst case, it can incite violence, but also it just drives people farther and farther apart from each other, right? And so you have, in the United States, we've now reached a point where people aren't just polarized, it's toxic polarization. There is a very little willingness to talk to people who have viewpoints different from yours. And if you don't talk to them, you can't understand their perspective. And so the barrier becomes wider and wider. In the long term, that can mean that you have actual segmentation and factionalization within society, which means that you don't have cohesion as a country. So if you don't have cohesion, if there's nothing uniting you, then, you know, you're in danger of breaking up into small segments, and you don't have a sort of common public space for debate, dialogue, anything. And then what's holding you together? So it's a massive threat.
Yeah, we see some candidates running in the United States for office, and it seems like the only question that they're really willing to answer is, who do you hate? And they're looking for supporters who say, I hate those same people too, and I will back you. And then they use that in order to close the door of a democracy, a multiracial democracy, which is what we aspire to having in the United States, and also trying to turn their back on inclusion. Inclusion that we know is the way forward with LGBTQ+, the disabled, racial and religious minorities. That seems to be the enemy of the authoritarianism, is inclusion. I mean, do you see that around the world?
We do. We see the rise of nativist, nationalist parties that are running on specifically anti-immigration, anti-inclusion platforms, and they're winning. And part of the reason for that is because people are scared. They're facing, like I said, a very complex environment with a lot of new challenges that are hard to figure out. And there's a lot of literature that shows how fear is very easy to manipulate by politicians. And so if you can make people feel like, oh, I hear you, I see why you're scared, and I'm going to give you a solution. And these people are to blame. And if you elect me, then I'll make sure that those people don't have any power and you'll feel better. And it's a very simplistic but effective way, because it's emotion. You're playing on people's emotions. But then the problem is, when they get into power, they're obviously not able to deliver on those things, because that would end up just essentially breaking a country apart, right?
Well, that might be the goal. There are charlatans of democracy who use the freedoms in order to bring about authoritarianism. This is something I have seen, and is that the thing to watch out for?
I think backsliding is kind of a red warning sign, because what backsliding means is that there's a leader who got into power through a valid election. That person has electoral support. And once they're in, they dismantle the building blocks of democracy from inside the democratic system. And so once you start to do that, once you start to lose the checks on effect on the executive, once you start to clamp down on people's ability to gather and say what's on their mind and ask the government just, you know, to talk, then you're really stabbing at the heart of democracy. So, yes, you're right. And we need to take the backsliding as a red warning.
Well, we see people attacking the validity of our elections, even people who got elected, saying that we have an election integrity problem, and they're attacking the faith that we have in our democratic process and trying to delegitimize what are legitimate and credible elections. And so they convince people that democracy doesn't work, and so therefore you should turn towards authoritarianism.
Mm-hmm.
And so
this is a really difficult problem, because actually elections in the United States are some of the cleanest and most credible processes in the world. There's actually, you know, after the last round of pushback against elections when Trump was defeated, you saw a bunch of investigations, some of which were done by the Department of Justice, that went in and looked and did recounts, you know, did the whole investigation and found no evidence of fraud. Things were clean and credible. So,
so we have to build trust.
People are scared. Yes, we have to build trust.
So
yes.
Trust we need an increased focus on trust, accountability, and with transparency. So not just here, but around the world. And so is that what you're trying to bring to the table with this Global State of Democracy report?
Yeah, we're trying to, show people what the situation is, but also motivate them to get involved and get engaged and stay engaged. And use the data that's in the report to call for the reform that they think is important.
But you do see there are glimmers of hope. Talk about that.
Absolutely. So we already see examples of people engaging in social contract renewal all over the world. And a really good example is in Chile, where they put together a very inclusive committee to redraft their constitution and renegotiate values, like I was saying before. The constitution that was on the that everyone was living under was from the Pinochet regime, and they're saying now we are a democracy, we need the rules that govern us to change. And so they came together and they've been talking, and even though the first draft text was rejected in a referendum, they're still going. They said, okay, it doesn't matter, the fact that it was rejected means we need to keep working. And that's the kind of dialogue we need to see happening all over the world. So that's just one example. There are tons of citizens' assemblies coming up all over Europe where, you know, regular citizens come together and discuss and debate and feed their recommendations then into government. We see youth becoming more engaged, demanding a change in the voting age. We saw a lowering of the voting age in Belgium, in Malaysia. So there's lots of examples.
Seema Shah, PhD, head of the Democracy Assessment Unit at the Stockholm-based International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance, International IDEA. Their report is The Global State of Democracy 2022, Forging Social Contracts in a Time of Discontent. Seema Shah, it was so good to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
When we come back from the break, we're talking about something that the media is calling the tridemic. We've got the COVID, we got the flu, RSV, what's happening at our local hospitals, and why you need to be on the lookout during the holidays. We're going to be talking about what's happening here in San Antonio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us.